Hello, and welcome to Life Beyond the Numbers, the podcast for people who are curious about how to have a more fulfilling work life. We live in a world largely driven by numbers, logic, and reason. But how we feel at work and about our work impacts us, our organizations, and society. There is a relationship between the numbers of our organizations and the life beyond the numbers. I'm Susan Mikhrylon, your host. I've lived and worked in many countries. I've met people who love what they do and people who don't, people who bring their full selves to work and people who won't. But one thing that I've learned that is common to us all is that we are all unique and have unique experiences. And it's helpful to know that there are others who think like we do, or have had struggles too, or have gone where we want to go, or can show us things we didn't know. So join me and my guests as we place a lens on the human side of work life by sharing insights, stories, and strategies to inspire you to let your uniqueness shine. Hello and welcome to episode 171 of Life Beyond the Numbers. The first Thursday of March is always World Book Day. And last month, to mark that occasion of World Book Day, Dr. Suzanne Evans, David Lee and myself got together to talk about books. We're all fairly book obsessed, and David has published a book already. Mine is due out in just over a month, and Suzanne is in the process of finishing her own book. So it seemed like the perfect opportunity to come together and talk about something that we all cherish, books. And so in this episode, the three of us, Suzanne, David and I, chat about books that we recommend to others, books that have been with us for a long time, and basically we just talk all things books. I hope you enjoy.
Hello everybody, and hello Susan and David. It's nice to be back together again. It's been a while. We are talking today about books. It was World Book Day a little while ago and we couldn't quite manage to get together for then, but we thought, especially as Susan has a book out imminently and I have a book out later on this year and David has already had a book out, so he's beat us to it, we thought we'd talk about books today. So we've all come with a heap of books to talk about and to share. We had a few prompts to think about, but basically it's books that we recommend a lot or books that have really changed our practice. I don't know who wants to go first. David, do you want to share a book that you've brought to the party today?
Sure. So this is one of my books I have given the most, The Right Questions by Debbie Ford. And it's just a great book. And I've reread it many times. And she has a list of questions to ask yourself, both in general in life and when facing a situation. So there are questions like, will this choice propel me toward an inspiring future or will it keep me stuck in the past? Will this choice bring me long-term fulfillment or will it bring me short-term gratification? Am I standing in my power or am I trying to please another? Et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah. I love that. We probably should add here that one of the reasons why we decided to have this conversation is that every time we speak to each other, we all go away with a massive book list of books that we've recommended to each other and have never read. And I could see Susan writing down and I was writing down as well because I have not read that one, but it sounds amazing.
Yeah, it does. It's definitely going on my list now. Another one.
Yeah, like I need any more in my massive pile of books. I like that. And David, do you recommend it to friends or colleagues or both? Is it the sort of book that anybody could read?
Yeah, friends, colleagues, and clients. It's full of wisdom. Yeah, it's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's gone on the list.
Yeah.
Is
And she's
there,
also a great storyteller
is
too.
she?
Yeah.
So is she a consultant or a therapist, or what's her background?
Well, she actually has passed away. Unfortunately,
Oh.
she died really young, sometime in her 50s.
That's
so is the New York Times number one best-selling author of The Dark Side of the Light Chaser, Secret of the Shadow, and Spiritual Divorce. So she was really big in the personal development and I think like spiritual development community.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. That's gone right on the list straight away.
It's always so amazing, isn't it? How there's just so many books in the world. And I was saying to Suzanne and I went into one of these big bookshops in Oxford when Suzanne visited, and it's huge. And I used to go in there when I was getting frustrating during my writing, just to show me that there are so many books in the world, and actually there's no need to worry too much, because the people that will find you will find you. And I think there's something amazing about sharing books with others as well, like you're doing. I mean, never came across that book, and it's like, why haven't I immediately? So thank you.
Yeah.
And do you, both of you, this question to both of you, do you prefer to read an actual book, or do you read electronic books, or a mixture of the two? David, you first.
Yeah, I'm all old school. I really like having the actual book, just in part because I try to minimize the screen time because of how much I'm at the computer doing other stuff. So yeah, I'm all about the old school books.
Yeah, me too. I'm all about the books. I am happy to go on holidays with 10 kilos of books and 10 kilos of clothes. More than happy. Everyone tells me I'm crazy, and I'm like, I don't care. It's what I like. This is my holiday. You do it your way.
Yeah, I'm the same. Sometimes I take books with me and then leave them behind.
Yeah.
So, if I think I've read that, I enjoyed it, but I'm not going to read it again, I leave it either at wherever I'm staying, in the hotel or in an apartment or something. I'll leave books behind. So there's books of mine dotted around the world.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to do, though, isn't
yeah.
it? Especially if people are coming and going. And there's often a tradition as well, I think, in some places, of leaving books like that, or book swapping in places. And yeah, it's nice.
I have to say, Susan, that bookshop you took me into, I was like, I died and gone to heaven. It was just unbelievable. It was so huge. And you could leave me in there and I'd be quite happy. I could live in there.
It was Willy Wonka's book factory.
Oh my God,
for book lovers, you know. Well, Blackwell's book factory, rather than...
Yes, yeah. Yes. Oh, it was awesome. And you're right. I think there is something, whether you're writing a book or you're creating something, it's nice to know that there's a space for all of it in the world. There's so much out there, and it will speak to different people. And as you say, it's quite comforting, isn't it, to know that.
And you'd think it would be the opposite almost. You'd think you'd go, well, what's another book to this? But actually, it always gave me that feeling of expansion rather than contraction.
That's cool, because that's exactly what I was going to ask. Because sometimes when I think about writing another book, it's like, oh God, do we need another book? You know?
Yeah.
I love it that had that effect on you.
And the bigger the bookshop, the better, because it's overwhelming. And you're kind of like, well, it doesn't really matter how this book comes out, because no one's ever going to find it anyway.
I was reading something the other day, and it was saying that you have to write the book that you want to read. And that's what you should be focusing on, rather than what else is out there, or because it's so easy. You do a Google search on the terms that you might want to use in your book title, and hundreds of books will come up, some of which may have a similar title, and that can be quite overwhelming. So for me, that was quite helpful. What do I want to read? And then I'll write that, and then hopefully other people will want to read it as well.
Exactly.
I like
the
that.
Book that's missing from the world.
Yeah.
That's what you're writing, the book that's missing from the world. So everybody's voice matters, and all of us have at least one book in us. For
yes.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know whether I'm going to write anymore. I think one might be enough, but who knows? Never say never.
Oh, I think I definitely think I'll be doing this again.
But you're at a different stage than me. I'm still at the, it's all on A4 paper on a big heap in my desk. The end is not in sight.
It is, though, Suzanne.
It is, it, yeah. No, I'm being overdramatic. So I'm wondering, Susan, if you have a book in your pile of books that's similar to what David was saying, so one that you recommend to people all the time.
Of course. And it's funny because I came away, I had to like rush around my bookshelves. I'm not at home today. And find those books that really stood out. And this book is The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. And this is probably the book I've gifted most over the years. And funnily enough, I haven't for quite a while now. And I think, well, in the workplace, I used to give it to people, but I also gave it to friends and so on. It's just such a simple book. And it's about four agreements that actually, at a time when I read it, I was probably mid-30s. I think it really helped me. And the four agreements are: be impeccable with your word. So speak from a place of integrity. Don't take anything personally. It's never about you. Don't make assumptions, for kind of the same reason, because we're assuming things that, and we're just making up stories in our head, and always do your best. And I just think they're really lovely four guidelines to live your life by. The book itself is probably not the best read ever, but the messages in it are quite profound, I think. And most people I've gifted it to have loved it as well, come back and said, oh, that's made a difference, thank you. So it is one of those, and it's really like neat and small and tidy, so you can kind of carry them around in your handbag. Not you, David, but I can. So I think, yeah, that's the one I've probably gifted the most. And somebody gifted it to me in the first instance as well.
Susie, I'm curious, and also curious what you have to say about this, Suzanne. The one about don't take it personally, it's never about you, I've always wrestled with that. I'm curious, again, both of your takes on it. To me, that one seems like one of those quote truisms that's only one side of the polarity. Because like when you think about other wisdom traditions where they talk about we attract into our lives who we are and how we project stuff onto other people, et cetera. So it always seemed to me like too simplistic, and it's a way to not look at our own stuff. So I'm just curious.
Like, so the way I mean, that's a really interesting point, and I wouldn't have thought about it necessarily in that way, but I get what you mean. And I think the way I took it at the time was, rather than me getting upset when somebody else is upset, say, for example. So let's say there's two people in a meeting room and I'm one of them and the other person is another person, obviously, and they get upset because of something that I've said. It may not be because I said it to them. It may be something that they're holding on to that upset them. And I think there was a great amount of freedom in that for me. Not license to be mean to people, but license to understand that, okay, I hit a nerve and maybe we need to stop this, but actually there was no malicious intent in my delivery. And if they're taking it personally, it's got to do with them. And I also don't need to take it personally. It doesn't relate to me necessarily. And I used to always think about it with crying, because I was a person that cried very easily. I don't so much anymore, but for a long time I did. And people never made me cry. But I would cry because of something somebody said. It was me. It was my reaction to it. It was no need for them to go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you cry. And they didn't. So that's the nuance. I hope I explained that okay.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, definitely. Yeah, it makes sense to me. I think I've been reading a book about the Stoics recently, and that sort of school of philosophy, and that chimes a lot with that, in that no one makes you do anything, no one makes you feel anything. You are doing that to yourself. And that, as you say, there's a certain freedom in that. And I liked what you said as well, Susan, about the stories that you tell yourself. That for me, I find it quite easy to go down that, oh, well, this happened. Oh, it must be because I'm a terrible person. Oh, dear, I'm rubbish. And all of that, you know, that we all do. And I think somebody said to me once, when that happens, that's a story that you're telling yourself. And the first thing you have to ask yourself is to do something based on reality. And the question she said to ask yourself is that true? And then you look at it again, well, no, it isn't true. And then you'd ask yourself it again. And to me, that's what I thought about when you said that, Susan. It's that I'm going off in my head with my own little story about what this is, why this has come from and what's caused it, but it might not actually be true. That's another one. I hadn't heard of that one. That's on my list as well now. Two books down. Haven't read either of them.
And what about you, Suzanne? What's the book that you gift most?
I'm going a bit off-piste with this one. It's less the sort of books that you've been talking about. And it's actually, this is the one at the moment I seem to be constantly recommending to people. And it's called Presentation Zen by Gar Reynolds. I love this book. David's nodding. I bet he's read it. Beautiful. It's just so awesome. If you ever use PowerPoint for anything, and also any kind of data storytelling in terms of tables and charts, this is the book for you, because it's all about deconstructing the way that we approach communication. And he says that fear leads to the dark side, which leads to PowerPoint, which leads to boring. So I've paraphrased, but that's kind of what he says. And the book is so brilliant in that he's got real life examples of presentations that he has done or things that he's seen, and he fiddles around with the colour or with the way it's presented. And it's all about being simplistic. So he uses the principles of Zen philosophy to drive it. And it's about being simple, being mindful, really being creative about how you use PowerPoint. And I recommend it all the time to people, because I'm constantly working with leaders and they'll show me, oh, we got this strategy presentation, and then it's awful. And when we've started talking about storytelling, then they say, well, how can I make my slides better? And this is the book that I recommend, but also to friends and colleagues as well. It's just, I love it. And it's so nice to look at. Look, you can just look at the pictures. It's so nice.
Oh, wow.
So, yes,
okay, that's gone on my list.
Have you read that one already, David?
Yeah, it really transformed my use of PowerPoint. Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. And bringing beauty into presentations. Yeah.
Yeah, it had the same effect on me when I first read it, that you just think, oh my goodness, I've been doing this wrong for 20 years.
And then you notice like 90% of the PowerPoints you see, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, and then you just want to give the book like to everybody. Like, that's how I end up. Like every time I'm in a presentation, I want to have a little stash of them under the desk and just be like, read it.
I love it. So do we do another round?
Have you got other ones that you recommend or that you share often?
Yeah, this is Frequency by Penny Pierce. This is one I've reread just, let's say, 6-8 times over the years. It is so good. So Frequency, The Power of Personal Vibration. And for people that I think are like ready for it, I'll share with it. And so it's all about, as you can tell by the title, The Power of Personal Vibration. Is she talks a lot about how to come to your quote home frequency so you can operate in the world as your best self and why your soul's here to do its thing. I think even for people who maybe aren't so much into the spiritual journey part, just the whole idea of the importance of getting into a productive energetic/emotional state. With your book that you just finished, you can relate to that. It's not all about that, but that's such, as you both know, such a huge part of engaging people in constructive conversations is what's that state that we come into it. It's amazing and it's very practical. It isn't just like this esoteric metaphysical kind of thing. So love it. And I've given it as gifts, recommended it many times. Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Doesn't it? I haven't read a book about that. And you can sense people's energy when you walk into a room. I can't say everyone does, but many of us do. We pick up energies from one another and everything. And there's something as well about taking responsibility, isn't there, for your vibration and what you're putting out into the world.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest, if not the biggest way we can help to make our corner of the world better. It's like, what can I do to have a higher frequency, a cleaner frequency, however you want to put it? So, yeah.
That's so interesting. I've never really thought about that before, but that is, yeah, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. That's gone on the list.
Yeah, the list continues to grow. And it's Penny Pierce, P-E-I-R-C-E. And she's got, like, not surprisingly, a million interviews, podcast interviews. So if you want to get a audio preview of her, that's a great way. Yeah.
Well, that sounds fascinating and different, I think, to things that I've read before. I'd be really interested to read that. That's going on the list. What about you, Susan? What's your next
Next one is the classic Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
I've read that one.
Yay! And David too.
Yeah.
And again, it's a really short book. It's packed with meaning, and it's about meaning. And I think that's the thing for me is that once we have hope, there's always a way. And I think the way he talks about knowing when prisoners, it's about World War II and being in a prison camp and knowing the people that are about to die, I guess their vibration changed, the ones that were giving up hope, and you could see it in them, and you would know by the end of that day that that person was no longer going to be with us. But he writes so positively about such a difficult time and about hanging on, always having something to believe in, to hope for, to make life meaningful. And I think the other thing I learned from that book was the space between that reaction and response, taking a moment when something comes at you to pause. And I mean, he writes, I couldn't find it. Usually I underline everything, but this is my partner's book, so I hadn't underlined it. So I couldn't find the line where he says it, but it's a beautiful line about finding that moment to pause.
I think it's something like in between stimulus and response is a space, and in that space is freedom, something like that. Yeah.
See, there we go. Thank you, David. Yeah, it's powerful.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Don't you find in organizations that people are a bit afraid of that space? They're a bit afraid of space and reflection and silence and everything else. And that causes so many issues.
And I think that space is often, if we think longer term, is a transition. And transition is so important. And I think we often rush to get to the end. We don't give transition really time to transform. We want the end result, but the transition is really, really important. And for me, that's the space between. And I think it's a very interesting space. And we all do some coaching work at times, and that space between giving people time to think, allowing thoughts to settle, is really, really critical as well.
Yeah, I really like Nancy Klein's work in that area. That paying beautiful attention, I think, is just so lovely. How you really hold what that person's saying and listen very carefully, I think, is a real skill and a really beautiful skill to have.
Who's that? Did you mention, Susan?
Nancy Klein. She wrote a book called Time to Think. And that's one of the phrases that I took when I read her book, which I haven't got in my heap of books, actually. Probably should have done. But yeah, it's paying beautiful attention to the person that you're with.
It's a lovely book. I think you'd really like it, David.
Oh, you would. Yeah.
And again, you can look her up. And I think she's written other books, and she's probably lots of podcasts and stuff like that.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great book. Okay.
And Suzanne?
Yes, I'm looking at my heap. I'm trying to think what I want to show you next. Okay, yes. Now, I think this one, I'm not sure it's still in print. It's called The Joy of Appreciative Living by Jacqueline Kelm. I got this one secondhand from Colorado Public Libraries. So The Joy of the Internet. I'm not sure it's still in print, but it's such a beautiful book. So I love appreciative inquiry and I use it a lot in my work. That the art of appreciating the best of what is the way I would summarize it. And this is a book about how you can build those principles into everyday life. One of the chapters is called Change Your Story to Change Your Life. So, you know, that grabbed me straight away. But it's different people's stories and exercises and questions to ask yourself to enable you to appreciate more of the great stuff that's around you. And you do it over 28 days of just different things to try each day. And yeah, it's a beautiful book. So you do a list every day of what you've appreciated that day. You do a question to focus on every day. And then you do an exercise every day around a vision. So what do you want to focus on in the future? And it takes about probably 5 minutes a day, but it just really changes your focus. And there's loads of stories in there about two people witnessing the same incident and having completely different perspectives on what that incident meant to them because they had a different perspective on the world. And this idea of appreciative is fullness and abundance and having that mindset rather than a deficit mindset. It's a lovely book. I think you can probably get it secondhand. I don't think it's still in print.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. And it reminds me a little bit of there's a course in Yale, the Yale School of Happiness, or not the Yale School of Happiness, but it's the happiness course from the Yale School of something or other. And Laurie, I can't remember her name now, but you can do this course. It's the most popular course that Yale has ever run. And it's a well-being one. And one of the things you learn to do right at the beginning is to savor something every single day and develop a gratitude practice and blah, blah, blah. And they measure your baseline of happiness at the beginning of the course. And then I think it takes about 6 weeks to do it. And again, it's a few minutes a day. And at the end, they measure your score again. And you inevitably go up because you are appreciating and you can conjure up all of those feelings. Nothing outside of you will give them to you. You need to find them inside you.
And I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, Susan, about this idea of there's a lot of things in the world. There's a lot of books, there's a lot of consultants, there's a lot of coaches in the world. But if you come at it with that feeling of abundance and that there's enough work for everybody, then you're never afraid by that. And I think I really like that approach. I use it all the time in my work, often in change situations. There's this, you know, you've got to get rid of everything and throw everything away. Well, actually, no, you don't. You have to stick with what's working and you don't have to change everything. But if you come at an organization with that mindset of, well, it all needs to be changed, then you're actually making life much harder for yourself and the people in it. Whereas if you're able to say, well, there's a load of really good stuff here, let's keep that and just change the stuff that needs to be changed. It's a far better approach to have, I think.
Yeah. I love, Susan, when you mentioned about the savoring, it flashed on to something that Adam Grant said, where he was talking about this study with first responders and nurses and how they found that when they were in the midst of doing good on the job, it didn't create a mood boost to them because they were so into doing their work. It wasn't until later that evening when they reflected on it that like salutary effects of altruism and doing good in the world helped them, were exhibited in them. And so whether it's savoring the sweet little moments we have with people, savoring what we have to be grateful for, or the good feeling of helping others, that concept of savoring and not just blasting through life. I love that point. Yeah.
Also the point of reflection up, I think, David, because reflection was the important thing there as well, because we do just get on through our days and we go and we go and go. And actually, if you take a moment to reflect and go, what did I get done today? What can I appreciate about others today? It shifts everything.
Absolutely.
As we're talking about reflection, can I share my next book? Because it's actually about reflective practice.
Go ahead.
Sorry to change the order, but it strikes me that it fits well with what we're talking about.
So it certainly does.
This is a really great book. It's by John Lorna and it's Reflective Practice in Medicine. So he's been on my podcast and he teaches narrative practice to GPs and doctors in the NHS. He's written some lovely books. This is my favourite. And it's all little case studies of different encounters that he's had, different consultations that he's had, and the sort of teaching that he does. And I just found it such a lovely read. There's things that have stuck with me from it, which I still talk about now. So he always talks about when we're reflecting and when we're asking questions, instead of digging a hole, so instead of going deeper and deeper questioning somebody, we need to help them to weave a tapestry, so to build the story, to enhance it rather than getting down into the detail. His work is so different from mine, but just to have a chance to peek into his world, it's a brilliant read. He's written another one about just stories from his life as a doctor, but this one is far more around how can you build practice and the questions that he asks and the approach he takes, anyone can use. It's lovely. It's a really lovely book.
Oh, cool.
And so interesting. And I think how wonderful that doctors are being trained in this art of reflective practice and helping patients build their narrative as part of their training now, rather than you treat the patient as a set of symptoms that you have to diagnose. It's actually allowing people to come and tell their story, which I think is amazing.
It is. And there's a study. It was in Nine Lies About Work, which is also a wonderful book, but I didn't bring it with me today. But there was a study mentioned there about if doctors just waited another 6 seconds, they would get the full story that the patient was bringing. But instead of rushing to diagnose before they've heard all the evidence, and I can't remember what they rushed in at, but it was a very short window, less than 20 seconds or something from when the person started talking. And if they only waited another 6, they'd get the full story.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was about how quickly physicians would interrupt.
Yeah.
And that's such a good reminder for all of us. In fact, I was talking to my sister about this recently. It's like, here, let me save you from finishing the thought. I will jump in and finish it for you. But it's like, no, that's not where I was going.
I think the other thing that he talks about, which really stuck with me, was that you have to destabilize yourself and be curious. And he said, there's so much doctors want certainty. You know, they are trained to be certain. And a lot of the work that he and his colleagues do is in encouraging them to destabilize that, and to ask questions and to be curious. And I thought that was a really interesting way of putting it, that to be curious, you have to be prepared to destabilize yourself and be comfortable with that instability. I thought that was quite interesting.
And it's really not what you imagine when you think about doctors. That needs to be embedded in the training, I guess, before it's embedded in a culture.
In American football, there's a term called calling an audible, where the quarterback, there's a play, and then the quarterback notices what the defense is looking like. So they call an audible, which is a different play. I'm sorry, I feel like I'm going to call an audible on myself based on what you just said, Susie, in the book that you said before, Man's Search for Meaning, Susan. So I'll just be real quick with the first one. When you mentioned, Suzanne, about how doctors are taught to be certain, and a book that I didn't think of until you mentioned that, which is so powerful, is the book on being certain. I think it's Dr. Robert Burton, I think that's his name, who is a practicing neurologist. Check this out. So On Being Certain is about the neuroscience behind the feeling of certainty and why that feels so good, and how the neural networks involved in the felt sense of knowing have nothing to do with the intellectual neural networks. You know? So you could be dead certain and dead wrong. I mean, we see that all the time. I listened to an interview with him about a year or two ago. He wrote this like 10 or 15 years ago, and he said he gave up writing nonfiction books and started writing fiction because he realized that his attempt to change people's minds and help them see that whole thing about you could be certain, dead wrong, approaching it logically didn't work. And so he entered the realm of storytelling, yay, storytelling, as a way to like slip underneath the conscious mind and introduce the sense of not knowing and therefore openness to a different point of view. So if I could throw that out, and then Susan, so I'll do a twofer like you did, Susan, if I can. And Susan, when you mentioned about the gap in stimulus and response, one of my all-time favorites that actually I've listened to as opposed to read is Don't Bite the Hook by Pema Chodron, the Buddhist teacher.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about how not to instantly react to somebody that we experience as an annoying life form. So how to sit in that space. So let's say somebody is snarky to us and we feel that flash of anger and we want to be snarky back as a way to discharge that immediate pent up energy. And she talks about how to be willing to sit with that and not, in my words, indulge in that and therefore weaken the connection between the stimulus and the reactive response and keep like breathing into that space so we become more in charge of our emotional responses. And I've re-listened to that many, many times. It's very needed for me. And I also, I've recommended it so many times. So thank you for mentioning Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah, I feel like I need to read that one. It sounds amazing.
When you were talking, Suzanne, as well, funnily enough, David, I was thinking about the networks, the default mode network and the task positive network. It was the old right and left brain, which is kind of left behind now because there's more science to it that they've found out that there's two networks and both of the networks can do certain things, but both networks have things that they do and the other one doesn't. But we can learn how to switch in and out of both of them because one is the logic one, you could say, and one is more the emotional one, for want of a better word. I know myself, if I'm in certain conversations, especially maybe if it was about accounting, for example, I know that the task positive network would be on. And I might not be aware that my default mode network, which is the empathic one, is off. So you actually have to learn how to toggle between both of those. And I'm guessing that that's what the doctors in a way have to learn, because that certainty is feeding from that task positive network, which brings me to my next book.
Yay!
If I may, which this book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain by Rockstar neuroscientist and psychologist Lisa Feldman Barrett. I mean, I don't know if anyone calls her a rock star, but I do. And I'm not sure I would recommend this book. So this is a bit controversial because it is tough going to read it. I mean, look, first of all, it's quite thick, but it is so fascinating and so interesting. And it changed my life. It really did, because from this book, I got the inspiration for my book, because she talked about how we have a body budget, and that's our brain's most important job, is to regulate our body budget, to make sure that we're staying healthy. You know, we regulate our temperatures and all of those things. So our brain is fascinating the way it can do all of that. And the term body budgeting just spoke to me as someone with a finance background. And so that's how I came up with accounting for emotions from this book. Now, what she has done, and I didn't bring this book, is she's made a more palatable version called 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. And that book is described as neuroscience for the beach. It's much easier to read, but they're both fascinating. And there's so much that we don't know, I think. And there's so much that has been common knowledge for quite a long time, that things like MRIs and science are opening our eyes now because they're getting more in-depth information. And this one is, I'm still holding it up because it was a fascinating read. And if you're really into understanding the science behind stuff, and she writes it like for normal people, it's just, it is heavy going. And I really recommend checking out Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's been on oodles and oodles of podcasts. She's done 2 TED Talks. It's well worth checking her out. And you will, as she says, your brain will be different by the time you finish reading her book. Actually, maybe it wasn't her, but anyway, it will be.
I've read both of those books, and I think, yeah, she just writes so beautifully, and you just spend the whole time like, what? I did not know that. It's fascinating. Have you read them, David?
I think I started How Emotions Are Made, and then put it aside, but makes me want to at least do the 7.5.
Yeah.
What was it? 7.5 what?
Lessons.
About the brain. Okay. Yeah.
And it's quite small book, and it's really written in a very conversational way, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. It's easier to read than the big one, I would say, having read both. I feel like, Susan, this is a good opportunity for us to hear about your book now that you've talked about the inspiration for it. So tell us all about it. When's it being published? What's it all about? Tell us everything.
And can you imagine? I had the printout of the cover and I forgot to bring it with me. But anyway, so my book, Leading Beyond the Numbers, How Accounting for Emotions Tips the Balance at Work, will come out on May 14th this year. So not long now, less than 2 months. And How Accounting for Emotions Tips the Balance at Work. I think that's what the book is really about. If we can bring emotions into the workplace, and not in a you're too emotional way, but actually the fact that we are all feeling, living human beings, and we do have these 2 different networks, and the default mode and the task positive node, and that we also have this felt sense, David, that you mentioned, this experiential felt sense that many of us are disconnected from. And it's about accessing more than just the brain, but trying to bring the body back into work. And so, for example, there's an accounting for the brain at work chapter, accounting for the body at work chapter, and then in keeping with the business accounting terminology is reconciling brain, body, and behavior. And I take the language of business and accounting to talk about these things and the body and the brain, but also soft skills, because that term annoys me, because there's nothing soft about being able to handle our emotional selves and regulate ourselves and know when somebody's dysregulated versus stressed versus uncomfortable. Well, I mean, you will be, whatever. But and also, I think the central message for me, I suppose, is you never know what's going on for someone else. We never know what's going on inside. We only see the outside. And all of us are adept at masking as well and saying we're fine when we're not, and not complaining and other things. I use a lot of charts and graphs to show that actually maybe you don't really know what's going on for people, without giving too much away. And it's filled with stories from the podcast and research from different books that I've read and amazing stuff that's come before. And yeah, and I'm really excited for it to go out into the world.
Cool.
And Suzanne, you were one of the early readers.
I was very honoured to have the joy of reading it. And it's such a great book. I said to Susan, I feel like it should be required reading for everybody when they start work, because it just helps you understand when you see behavior in the workplace that makes you feel uncomfortable, you can understand why that might be. You can understand how to regulate yourself and to take care of yourself so that you can be the best you can be. And it's such a great read. And you're right, it is full of stories from your own experience as well, and from other people's. I just found it really fascinating. And I took so many things away from it that I thought, oh yeah, I need to do more of that, or I need to do less of that. And yeah, it's a really good read. It really is. I read it so quickly. I know when we spoke about it, Susan, you said you weren't expecting the early readers to necessarily read the whole thing, but I read it in about 2 days. It was just like a page turner.
That's amazing. Thank you.
That's awesome.
And Suzanne, you are in the middle of yours.
I am. So mine is being published in November. I'm a bit further behind the news. I'm just working up the final draft at the moment. Here it is. Here is my book, not a book. So yes, it's going through the draft process at the moment. So mine is called Change Stories: How to Have Powerful Conversations, Tell Inspiring Stories and Build Engagement. So it's about how to build stories into your change practice. But there's also a lot in there about reflective practice and appreciative inquiry, as we talked about earlier. There's a whole section on visual storytelling. So I draw on the work of Gar Reynolds in there. It's data storytelling, how to tell stories through numbers. Yeah, I was laughing earlier saying I was never going to do it again. I have quite enjoyed the process. It was the getting started of it that I found difficult, whereas actually once I was in it, I was all right. And then it just flew out of me. But it was the actually sitting down to start was the bit that I found difficult.
I think that might be normal. What about you, David?
Yeah, you oftentimes hear people say, real professionals, they sit down like the same time every day and write. They don't wait to be inspired. Whenever I've tried that, it's just like, shoot me.
Sounds idiot.
Yeah. So two things. One is, when I feel inspired, it just flows so easily. And what I've been doing more, and actually it gets back to the whole frequency thing that we talked about earlier, is I will prime the emotional / energetic pump by reading something that's inspiring, doing something that's fun, watching a video that's uplifting, whatever. And then once it like clicks into gear, then like run to my desktop and start typing away. And that seems to work pretty well for me.
And tell us about your book, David, because you are already published. You're one step ahead of Susan and I.
Yeah. So it's Dealing with a Difficult Coworker is the title. And it's volume one of the Courageous Conversations at Work series. We'll see if there's a volume two. Basically, it's story-based. It tells the story that I use when I do constructive conversation seminars. The story provides like the framework for it. And my intention in writing it was to make something that's an easy, quick read. So it's not daunting. So it's only, something like 80 some pages, and that can be used as the foundation of a workshop where everybody reads it. And then they talk about, how would you deal with this? And I walk through, back to the stories we tell ourselves in our emotional state. I walk through my process of being enraged at this coworker, plotting my revenge, and going from furious to getting curious, revising the story I'm telling myself, getting into a more productive state, and then actually having the conversation. The thing I wish I had done differently, I wanted to do different like tight genres of conversations. So I thought, since everybody has difficult coworkers, and that's a story I always use, I'll start off with that. The thing I wish I had done instead was to make it more generic, because my goal was for employers to buy it in bulk for their employees, which they've done. But it dawned on me later, not the ideal message if you're buying bulk copies for your employees dealing with difficult coworkers. I should have named it, my original title was Let's Talk for a Change. That's a little more positive. Like all those pesky coworkers you have to deal with, like, here, this will help you deal with those losers. I was thinking this morning, I might just rewrite it using that more positive framework. So we'll see.
It could be the second edition, David.
Here we go. I love it. I love it. Oh, and one quick thing to loop back to something you said, Susan, about soft skills. That's always been a pet peeve of mine, using that. I just read someplace about the origin of that term. It was actually a military term where when they were designing training programs, the hard skills were any skills related to something like hard objects like tanks and guns and stuff. And soft was any type of skill that wasn't related to those hard objects.
Wow.
Which I thought was pretty interesting. But
the soft bit is the humans.
The pesky little human element. So yeah, what are the analogies I use with that? Like trying to manage and lead in today's world using old school management practices is like trying to run your Windows computer with like Windows 95. It's like...
like my dad does.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, mine too, probably.
Yeah, it's like so-called soft skills. That's the software to run the business. It's kind of important to make sure it's updated. So anyway, a thread from before.
Interesting. Well, I've read your book. Well, I've read both of your books, and you are both quoted in my book for various parts of it. There is a whole section in my book, David, about preparing for courageous conversations, or my hatred of difficult conversations, and when organizations say we're going to do some training around having difficult conversations, and it just makes me want to shoot myself because you're immediately putting that into people's heads that it's difficult. So yeah, there's a whole section on that, because I want people to just talk to each other more in organizations, and so if they go into it thinking it's hard, then they won't do it. You're both in there, and your podcast episodes are both talked about. When it's ready, you'll both get a copy to have a look at.
It's awesome.
Ooh, looking forward to that. And I haven't read yours yet, David. I must put that on my list as well.
It's a very good read. Everyone must go and buy it before the second edition comes out.
That rare first edition copy.
I shall send it to you to be signed, and then you can send it back.
That's great. Where are we in our cycle?
I have three books next to me, which means I've talked about three, but I feel like we've all talked about at least three or four others that weren't here in physical form, but that's fine. That's okay. David, do you want to go next?
Okay, sure. The two that I mentioned replaced Julia Cameron's Prayer to the Great Creator. It's kind of like the daily devotional version of The Artist's Way. It's super awesome.
I love
awesome.
The Artist's Way.
So, yeah. So instead, I'll just go to The Soul's Code. And what I love, so James Hillman is dead now, but he was a famous Jungian analyst. And what I love about it, to be brief, is he talks about how traditional psychology and its perspective on looking at childhood, especially childhood traumas, to explain why we're like messed up or have all our issues, is too small of a model to look at the human journey. And instead, he draws on I don't know if Plato was the first one who wrote about this, but the concept of how when the soul incarnates onto earth, it has a particular destiny and mission, and how instead of looking at your messed up childhood for clues of why you're messed up as an adult, It's looking at childhood for clues of the acorn that will grow into the oak. And so the things that you experience, the things that you are into, your unique gifts and fascinations are all like clues to the mystery of the you that's unfolding. And back to storytelling, he shares like really fascinating stories about famous historical figures and using this model to see the clues of how they were in childhood. They were foreshadowings of who they blossomed into. It's just super. It's also dense reading, like the how emotions are made, but it's worth it. And it's one I've read partly because it's so dense. I've read multiple times over the years and because it's just so cool.
What if you don't remember those things from your childhood, those signs, those?
Yeah, man, great question. From personal experience, I don't remember a lot of my childhood, and I'm more of like a broad brush kind of person. My siblings remember more about me and my childhood than I do. And so like my sister's a great chronicler for me, like, oh, that happened. I have no memory of that. So if siblings are great, childhood friends are great.
Parents, I guess, as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting, I think, because I think a lot of people don't remember stuff that they were obsessed with or whatever. I don't know. I don't remember a lot either.
Here's what comes up for me is maybe the takeaway isn't so much how can I get more historical data, but whatever historical data I have, back to the stories we tell ourselves, I'll speak for myself. Okay, let's not take my history and tell myself a story about like, no, here's why I'm stuck in this area, or here's why I have trouble with such and such, or here's all the ways I'm flawed and imperfect. It's more about whatever it is, the story, what are the clues, like reframing, what are the clues in this experience that I had about what my soul's calling is. In a quick, for instance, that grew up with a father who really struggled with emotional self-regulation, hated his work, not really happy with his life, took it out on the kids. Coming from originally from a therapy background, I was like hyper-focused on adult child issues, all that kind of stuff. And like, oh, woe is me. So that's one story I could tell. Another, and this is where the benefit of an outsider seeing us, that, and I think I'd shared this with you all some other time, how years ago, a friend and colleague who was super intuitive, she asked me about what was childhood like, and I shared it with her. She said, "That's so interesting. It's like you chose a profession that could heal your father." And at the time, I wasn't doing career coaching, but I'm sure part of my fascination with that was he felt trapped in a profession that he hated. But at the time, the work I was doing was how do you make the workplace more humane? Because he felt disrespected and he hated his work. And so that's a real different story in terms of making sense out of childhood. So.
Mm. Oh, thanks. Fascinating.
It reminds me of a conversation, David, that you and I had about career journeys. One of the questions you asked me was things that I enjoyed as a child. What were they? And how's that then been taken forward? Because you do loads of things as a child and then you forget about them, don't you? Because you go on to become all serious. And then you can find them again. And I remembered when I was talking to you about how I used to spend hours and hours and hours rewriting books. So I would take a book, honestly, it's hilarious. And I would get a notebook and I would write the whole thing out again with my own illustrations and everything. This is how I would spend my school holidays. It's doing this. My parents' loft, there are hundreds and hundreds of these books that I have created from a really young age. And so I was always fascinated by books and by writing. And then I sort of forgot about it for years and years. And then it was only when I started doing my PhD, I think, that I was like, I love this. I love this writing lark. I completely forgotten about it. And it was in that conversation I had with you, David, that I remembered it. I hadn't thought about it to that point.
So plenty of first editions in your attic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're not great. Terrible handwriting.
Isn't that amazing, Susan? Isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
Like, what a cool, amazing example of the acorn saying who the oak. Yeah, that is so cool.
Yeah. And it's funny because as an adult, I always told myself I wasn't creative. And actually, when I think back to my childhood, I really was. But I think I wasn't creative in the sense of doing a painting or that sort. And in my mind, creativity was that. Whereas actually, I was being really creative. I played musical instruments and all that sort of thing. It's only in more recent years that I've started to think I am a really creative person. And it's been like sort of finding myself again, finding this aspect of myself again. And it's been great. So yeah, that really resonated with me, David, that idea of the acorn that grows into a tree.
Cool.
Beautiful.
Susan, have you got another book to share? We've probably got time for one more each, I reckon.
Yeah, I have three books here and I'm going to just pick one of them, which is completely different from what we've been talking about, actually. And this book is called Season of Blood by Fergal Keane. And it is about the Rwandan genocide. And the reason I picked this one, well, I suppose 1994, I mean, it's 30 years now nearly since the genocide, because it was April, actually, 1994. And I was in university and I didn't know anything about what was going on. I knew something about Hutus and Tutsis and that was about it. Almost 1 million people were killed in 10 days or something. I mean, it was just unbelievable what happened in that time. And Fergal Keane is an Irish journalist, and I think he was based in South Africa or somewhere, so he was sent up there to report on it. And I mean, man's inhumanity to man. And he went to pieces, I think, afterwards and everything. But his book is just such a beautiful tribute to remembering what's happened in the world and not forgetting. And I was one of these people that was like, oh, I'm so sick of hearing about World War II and so sick of hearing about all of these wars, and would they ever just talk about something else? I went to Rwanda before reading this book and I didn't visit anywhere that had memorials to the genocide because I felt it was morbid and so on. But I just wanted to read the last few lines from this book, because this is one of the reasons that it really stays with me. There will be many who say that I was foolish, naive to ever have had such faith in man. Maybe they are right. In any event, after Rwanda, I lost that optimism. I am not sure that it will ever return. For now, I can only promise to remember the victims, the dead of Nyarubuye, the wounded and the traumatized, the orphans and the refugees, all of the lost ones whose hands reach out through the ever lengthening distance. At the very outset, I asked what it was that dreams asked of us. Perhaps they request something very ordinary, simply that we do not forget. And I just thought it was such a powerful ending to such a beautiful book, because he had nightmares. And I think the nightmares basically were calling him to write this book. And I have so much underlined in this book as well. There's so much beautiful writing that even though you're reading about something traumatic and horrific, it's beautifully written and it's a memoir. And I think we shouldn't forget, because look at what's going on in the world now. We did forget.
Gosh, that sounds amazing. Thank you for sharing that one with us, Susan. It's another one to add to my list. It sounds incredible. And he's such a great journalist. All his work he does on the BBC is just amazing. And he's really suffered for it too, hasn't he, in his own mental health. And, you know, that sounds amazing. I'm assuming you haven't read that one either, David. That would be a new one for you to add to your list.
No.
I think it's my first strike today.
Okay, yeah, you're in a brand new one.
If I could sort of play off that, so of my last two, I'll just select this one, and that I've already mentioned, I know, in other places. Good Old Bittersweet by Susan Cain. Yeah. Yay! The beauty and the sadness in the world, and transforming or transmuting sadness into beauty. And that wonderful line, I hope I get it right, that she quotes in C.S. Lewis about the feeling of bittersweet is the longing for that which we know not. I think that's how it goes. So it's just this vague sense of there's a better world, and just longing, you know, wanting that better world. But it's just a kind of a far off memory or sense. But yeah, oh man, bittersweet. So given it as gifts, recommended it a million times, reread it. It's amazing. Yeah.
I feel like those two would be good ones to read together. Maybe your recommendation, Susan, and then followed by Bittersweet, that might be quite a nice juxtaposition together.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Helping to transmute some of the pain of the reality of the horror in the world. Yeah.
Because it can make you feel a bit helpless, can't it? I've read Susan Cain's book, and I think it helps with that in a way, that sense of helplessness and sadness, as you say, the way the world is. Have you read, was that, you were waving one, Susan, is that the same book or is that one of her other books?
That's her other book, Quiet.
I didn't see. Oh, I thought it was, okay.
Yeah, it's quite hard to see the part. I did bring that with me because I've recommended it to a lot of people and given it as gifts as well. But it's so long since I've read it. And David, one of the things you've spoken a lot about today is rereading. And it's not something I do a lot of. I mean, there are some books that I've underlined and I'll go back over passages. And as I underline something, I often make notes for myself elsewhere about why that resonated with me and try and have a conversation with the author almost about it. But rereading isn't something I do a lot of. And I'm curious about that for you.
I find that it's kind of like rereading your journals. It's, you know, all these amazing epiphanies that I forgot. And then it's like, oh my God, this is so awesome. And I love that you work with it, which obviously helps it embed even more into your consciousness. That's super cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not much of a one for rereading. I mark books up, I stick little post-it notes in them, I underline things, I highlight things, I fold pages over, which I know some people disapprove of heartily, but if I'm reading a book, it will end up trashed. That's a sign of a good book. But I don't usually go back to read the whole thing. I'll go back to the bits that I've highlighted rather than the whole book.
I think it was, what's her name that wrote Harry Potter? Can't think of her name right now.
J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling. She said she loves nothing more than seeing a book that is just beaten to bits. It's a sign the book was loved and read and reread and all of that. And yeah, I feel like that too.
I think a lot of authors of cookbooks say that as well, don't they? That they love it when a book is covered in food spatters and have scribbled out something and written something else in instead, because it shows that they've been working with it and using the book for what it's intended. I know some people really disapprove of my practice of attacking books and folding pages over, but I it works for me.
It's your book. You can do what you like.
Exactly. I'm going to share one more before we finish, if that's okay.
Yes.
So this is one for me. So this is published by Practical Inspiration Publishing, which Susan and I are publishing with this publishing house, but that's got nothing to do with it. It's called The Long Win by Kath Bishop. And this, for me, had a really big impact on me for two reasons. One, it really challenged a limiting belief that I had about myself. So I've always seen myself as not sporty. I will probably have had this conversation with you before, each of you, I suspect. Kath Bishop is an Olympic rower, and she tells a story right at the beginning of the book about how she was really terrible at sport at school. And so it was because it was the wrong sort of sport for her. And when I read that, it was like, oh my goodness, that's amazing. Because she then went on to be in the Olympics, which is the sort of pinnacle of sportspersonship. But then you think, well, yeah, it's because she wasn't given the right opportunities. And so that for me was like, okay, I'm not going to become an Olympian. But actually, this narrative that I tell myself about not being sporty is just not true, because there's people like her out there who also had that narrative, then found the sport that they were amazing at, and then made a career out of it. For me, that was almost in the first couple of pages. It was like, oh my goodness, that's amazing. But you can see there's a whole load of little sticky notes in this one. But what she writes about is the idea of, she talks about our obsession with winning, and how in society and in organizations, it's just become an obsession. And in it's made the environment of organizations quite combative. And that really struck me from a change management's perspective. It's like leaders and employees, people who are resistant to change, people who are trying to introduce the change. And she talks about trying to create a more collaborative approach to working together. And again, that really stuck with me. And probably a bit like you were saying, Susan, with the book that led you to start writing your own book. Well, it was finding this book, reading in it and thinking, well, maybe there is another way to do change management. And I went to her book launch, and then I met Alison Jones, who's the head of Practical Inspiration Publishing. And then I went and did a short course with Alison about writing a book proposal. And now here I am having a book published. So it was this book that actually changed that for me, because it does. Claire Balding, who, David, you probably won't know, but who's a very well-known broadcaster in the UK, she writes on the back this book called Change Your Outlook on Everything. That's not an exaggeration. It's just and such a great read. She's had the most amazing career as well. So post-Olympics, she became a diplomat and a negotiator, and she's just, yeah, she's been on my podcast as well. What a woman. She's Kath Bishop. It's just amazing. So yeah, that's the last one I wanted to share.
And I have that book on my bookshelf. I just
It's such a nice read. It's, yeah, I mean, it's so much, I think particularly reading it as a woman, there's so much of the kind of, she talks a lot about macho narrative and how you've got so many, you know, great men in business, and it's all comes from a very macho perspective. And you know, yeah, it's really interesting. I loved it. It's a great read. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Cool.
So neither of you read that one, so I get that one. But at least you've got it on your bookshelf already, Susan, so you don't have to go out and buy it.
Yeah, unlike the 25 books I've got from David.
I know. Even when we're not meeting to talk about books, we end up with a massive reading list. My Amazon wish list is enormous every time I speak to you.
It was brilliant, though. I loved that.
It was. We should do it again.
Such a rich conversation.
Yeah.
I think our taste in books is similar but different. And I think that's really nice. Excellent. Well, thank you both for that conversation. I shall go shopping immediately and buy a whole load of extra books.
No, you have to write your own book first.
I know.
You have permission to wait.
I can't read it. There's no space in my head for any more books. Thank you. It's been fantastic as ever. Thank you both very much for joining me and having this conversation about books. Let's do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been lovely to, because it's been a while since we've done one of these together like this, and it's been just so lovely. I love spending time with you too.
Thank you. Thanks both. See you soon.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the paths we traversed on today's episode. If something rang through for you, be sure to let me know. Or maybe you can share this with someone in your life who would benefit from listening too. And if you enjoy helping others, I'd be so grateful if you would leave a review, so that people who might also be curious about their own life beyond the numbers can discover this podcast too.